Hello, my name is Isabel Trick. I am an Associate Director in the Global Macro Team at Global Council. Welcome to our podcast series, The Global Month Ahead. Towards the beginning of each month, I get together with colleagues from across GC to delve deeper into three of the most interesting events and developments taking place in the month ahead. You can expect to focus on issues with broader geopolitical or economic importance, and we will make sure you know more than your friends and colleagues when these topics will inevitably hit the news. For the April edition, we will focus on the upcoming Indian elections, the last session of the EU Parliament before the EU too heads into election season, and the IMF and World Bank spring meetings. It would not be 2024, the famous year of elections, where nearly half of the world's population is heading to the polls, if we didn't have an election featured in this month's podcast. And this one is quite literally the biggest one, because on the 19th of April, India, the world's largest democracy, starts its multi-phase and multi-week election process. More than 970 million voters are eligible to vote. To discuss this, I have Ross Nugent with me. Ross recently went to India and he attended the Raisina Dialogue, India's top geopolitics conference. He brought back a host of really interesting insights. So thanks for being here with us today, Ross. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Isabel.
Let's start with a practical question. How does India organize an election on such a massive scale spread across its 28 different states and including nearly a billion voters?
Well, that's right. We are talking about 970 million eligible voters spread across 28 different states. And that's the proportion that many of us in the smaller democracies are not familiar with at all. We now know the election will run across seven phases from April 19th to the final vote on June 1st. This is the second longest election in India's history, though they are generally quite long anyway. We're talking 15 million polling officers and security forces involved at those polling stations, 5.5 million electronic voting machines, and over a million polling stations. So staffing this election is a logistical challenge. And if the country were to vote on one day, it would probably be impossible to provide the requisite security and election integrity over the course of those couple of weeks. And while India's election-related violence has been declining over recent elections, the risk remains in some states and some pockets of the country, and it means a few days are needed to move police and military forces across the states to ensure the integrity of those elections and to ward off any kind of post-election violence, though that seems quite limited and the probability of that is quite low. There are some downsides here for some of the parties involved. Of course, the longer the election, typically the more expensive the election from political parties' perspectives. And the incumbent political party, the BJP, and the incumbent Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, are tremendously well-financed compared to, say, the leading opposition party, the Indian National Congress, who argue that they are at a disadvantage here. The longer the election, the more likely they are to run out of funds, particularly given some of their bank accounts have been frozen in an ongoing tax investigation. So it is a long election by necessity, but it does come with political downsides for some of those parties involved.
The scale and the figures that we're talking about here, it really is staggering. And it does make it make sense, these opposition complaints. I understand it does sound legitimate. It certainly sounds like an expensive and a pretty long undertaking. And I guess with it being so complex and taking such a long time, I don't think we're expecting to hear about the results before we're heading into June. And I guess I'm setting myself up here for my next question, because I guess we've got the Prime Minister, Modi. He's seeking his third term. He's been in power for 10 years. He's probably the most influential Indian leader on the international stage since Indira Gandhi. And the polls are definitely looking pretty good for him right now. What would you say are his realistic prospects of being re-elected?
Well, his prospects look very favourable. Indian polls, particularly at the national level, tend to be unreliable. It's very hard to poll a representative sample of 970 million voters across so many states with so many different languages and ideological preferences and religions. So we shouldn't put too much stock in national polls, but it's certainly true that Modi is very popular, particularly in the north of the country. And I would say that the BJP is set to comfortably win the next election. Even many in the opposition would concede that point. The party will probably be rewarded for what has been unprecedented infrastructure spending and also a sustained fall in extreme poverty. So to give you two examples there, Since Modi was elected Prime Minister in 2014, spending on transport has tripled as a share of India's GDP, and those living in extreme poverty have fallen from around 19% to something looking like 12%, though those figures are never wholly accurate. But I think most would agree that extreme poverty in India continues to fall, and he will be rewarded for this. So, of course, it's not just his economic record that will give him somewhat of a tailwind going into this election. His nationalist appeal, particularly among Hindus, remains very potent in the more rural and populous north of the country, and particularly after the BJP fulfilled two of the three major promises that propelled it into the national spotlight in the 1990s, and to some extent propelled Narendra Modi into the office of Prime Minister in 2014. The first of those is revoking semi-autonomy from Jammu and Kashmir, and the other is opening more recently, actually earlier this year, a Hindu temple or a mandir in Ayodhya, which is a very sensitive but very important cultural and religious moment for many, many, many Hindus. So on both the social side and the economic side, he has a buffer going into this election. At the moment, the BJP has around 303 seats in the Indian lower house, which is the more significant of the two houses in the Indian parliament, and hopes to increase to 370 and perhaps 400 seats when combined with their allies. So that would mean 400 seats of 543 seats total. That would be an enormous majority for Modi if he were to secure it or anything like that. And of course, he's also helped by a relatively fractured and ineffectual opposition, not just in the Indian National Congress, which has proven incapable of penetrating what we call the Hindi Belt, which is the more populous Hindi-speaking north of the country where the vast swathe of the Indian population resides. They've struggled to make gains there, struggled to make inroads, and they're currently led by a member of the Nehru-Gandhi dynasty who have governed India, or certainly led India for most of its post-independence history. But unfortunately for them, they're not cutting through in those parts of the country where Modi's digital campaign in particular is extraordinarily effective and has proven so in 2019 and in 2014 before that. So I'd say Modi's re-election prospects are very high. As I said, most in the opposition would even concede that. And I would say most Democratic leaders look at Modi's approval rating with envy. I mean, it usually floats somewhere between 75 to 80% approval. This is unheard of in most other democracies, and particularly in one so diverse as India's. So I think Modi is probably cruising for re-election here.
Yeah, your very first point there is well taken about the reliability of polls, especially given the surprises we've seen across the world ever since 2016. But equally, the track record we've outlined for Modi is pretty impressive. And those approval ratings do probably mean that Modi does have this in the bag regardless. And what you said about the opposition is quite interesting as well. So they're clearly struggling in the Hindu belt, but do you think there's other areas where the opposition parties are able to do something that might chip away at Modi's majority, or rather maybe stop Modi from having an even more dominant majority than those 400 seats you were forecasting?
Well, Modi has always struggled to make inroads in the south, and these are typically India's wealthiest states, where Modi is probably least popular. It's not to say he's really unpopular, but he's much less popular than he is in the north. And people often make quite a big deal of India's north-south divide. Sometimes that's overstated, but politically it certainly exists. So where the BJP has been relatively dominant in northern India, other parties, the Indian National Congress, as well as others, for example, the Communist Party of India, does well in certain states in the south. And therefore, Modi's popularity is not necessarily ubiquitous, but it is extraordinarily strong where it counts and where the voters reside, and they typically reside in the north. So what are the opposition doing to counter this? Well, they're trying to come together because, as you've alluded to there, no single party has the electoral strength to overcome the BJP. So their thinking is that by coming together in a new alliance, they can hopefully at least shrink Modi's majority and, in a best case scenario, potentially rob him of one, although that's unlikely. So this new Indian National Developmental Inclusive Alliance, the India Alliance for short, has come together to try and unseat or deprive Modi of his majority. I think most people would say this is a deeply, deeply fractured alliance that simply cannot coalesce around policy positions, but can coalesce around their dislike of the incumbent government. So what unites them is their dislike and opposition to the BJP, but they are often not united on many, many other issues, whether they be cultural, economic, or overall political issues, you're talking more than two dozen parties here. It's very, very difficult to bring together that kind of coalition and to maintain some degree of stability and to allocate different constituencies or to allocate different regions of the country where some parties are more favored than others. But that is the tactic being employed at the moment. It doesn't seem to be overly effective. And if anything, gives strength to Modi's argument that the BJP is the only single party capable of governing India with a majority. His argument is not only that we are the only party fit to lead the country, but that we're the only party that could actually lead the country because we are a national party that has a foothold in every single constituency, in every single region, and few other Indian parties can boast the same.
It definitely sounds like an uphill battle for the India Alliance. It sounds like they might have had a knack for finding a very nice acronym there, but otherwise maybe not so many things that unite them. For the last question, I'd like to move away from the election for a moment and actually talk to you about India more broadly, India as an investment destination, because you and I have been having some interesting conversations with clients who are increasingly interested in India, particularly in the light of sort of de-risking from China debates. And do you think from your time in India, is there one thing that you think investors are getting wrong about India all the time and is worthwhile for them knowing now?
Well, that's exactly right. India is trying to position itself as the premier China plus one candidate. So for large multinationals seeking to diversify their supply chains, India wants to position itself as the obvious alternative with a very large population, large geography, in some cases natural resources, and a large demographic dividend, a large working age population, which it will have for the next couple of decades at the very least. So that is an effort being made by the current government and probably will be made by any government. I think one thing that perhaps investors are underestimating here is the degree to which the Western countries like the US and Europeans are actually going to converge or align with India. I think that there's an idea that perhaps India and the West are going to converge in their skepticism or in some cases concern about China's geopolitical behavior, and that therefore that will set the scene for a rapprochement between the two. I wouldn't say that's overstated. I think there's no foreseeable clash of interest that could derail the relationship between India and the US, for example, but a more substantive partnership is not necessarily guaranteed. So India will not become what some in Delhi refer to as a second Japan, which integrates fully with the democratic Western club on issues such as China and Russia and toes their line. I think most agreed that India is likely to become a second Saudi Arabia, which certainly does clip into the Western system when it suits them, but is also prepared to chart its own course where it suits them as well. And so I think there is a risk that, you know, the relationship will not always be sailing quite as smoothly as it is right now. But certainly the multinationals we spoke to have an optimistic view of India. They also welcome the idea of policy continuity. Even if they have some misgivings about Modi and the BJP, they will have some appreciation for policy continuity. One thing international investors are looking for is consistency, predictability, and having one party in power for what's going to look like probably 15 years does give you a degree of policy continuity, particularly on infrastructure and particularly on capital investment, which the Indian government has stepped up significantly even in the past year. So there are upsides and downsides. I think, you know, one thing investors might also be getting wrong is treating India like a monolith, as though it is a really well-oiled, cohesive, unitary single market. I think anyone who does business across India's 28 states will tell you it can be quite fragmented. The relationship between the national government and state governments, particularly in the south, can be quite contested, can be quite or less than harmonious, shall we say, at times. And that sometimes makes it hard for the national government to implement nationwide reforms. I mean, for Modi to really implement nationwide reforms that creates a really well-oiled single market, internal market, he will have to have the cooperation of the southern states on his side. So the politics intersects with the economics here all the time. And so there's a lot to be optimistic about in India, but as is the case in anywhere, you've got extraordinary challenges. So this could also include really high unemployment, particularly among young people. The statistics on that are often hard to get your hands on. Either they're inaccurate or perhaps poorly put together. And you also have quite a large skills deficit. So India has a way to go in making the most of its demographic dividend. It has the young working age population. The question now is, can you marry that young working age population with capital? And can you marry them with skills? Can you get a skilled young working age population that is located where capital wants to invest? I think that will be the big challenge for Modi a third term.
Thanks very much, Ross. Those are some absolutely fascinating insights, both into the election and the broader picture of India as an investment destination. We'll keep our eyes on both. So thanks very much for joining me, Ross.
Thanks for having me.
From the 22nd of April to the 25th of April, the European Parliament will meet for its last plenary session before the EU parliamentary elections in June. So this does not only mean a rush to finalise any priority files, but also a very good opportunity for us to look ahead to the elections themselves. To discuss this, I have Tom White with me, our Europe director. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Isabel.
So, Tom, this is clearly an important moment in European politics. So to kick us off, could you give us a sense of the significance of this final plenary session? What are some of the key legislative files that need to be addressed before the deadline?
Certainly. Well, we've discussed on previous podcasts how the European Parliament has gained in influence and power over the last few decades when I've been working on this intensively. But actually, the European Parliament's power starts to diminish a little bit as you approach the elections, because effectively MEPs are focused on their legacies. They want to make sure they have actually struck deals. And they'll also be wary of files that they've been working on perhaps disappearing and not being taken up in the next cycle. So we are seeing a fairly frantic period of deal making at the moment. And we actually have two plenaries in April. We have a mini plenary in Brussels in the middle of the month, and then a more extensive one in Strasbourg at the end of the month. And it's the second one that we're going to be most focused on, because they will essentially be deciding whether they accept some of the deals struck by the Belgian presidency, which has proved itself to be quite efficient, quite resourceful in securing agreements on issues around due diligence, around packaging and other contentious elements of environmental policy. There will also be agreements to look at in the areas of financial services, energy policy, and late payments, which affect mainly the retail and wholesale sectors. So I think we will see a lot of perhaps reluctant agreements being struck, partly because MEPs will also be mindful of the need to be setting up their campaigns in their national activities, where they will, although they will focus mainly on domestic issues in these kinds of elections, they'll also want to show that they've done a good job in Brussels, that they've pursued the goals of their parties and their voters. So essentially, coming out of the session, apart from what has been agreed, we'll also get a sense of what has not been agreed, and maybe what we need to focus on for the next cycle, what will be inherited, what might be quietly dropped.
So it really sounds we're heading into this last session kind of off the back of quite a successful Belgian presidency, like you described, with agreements on due diligence, packaging, financial services, energy. And it does sound like there's now going to be a certain amount of pressure to really get things done in this final session as MEPs look at cementing their legacies. And of course, a very good point there at the end of what remains on the table for the next parliamentarians. And I guess that's a perfect segue to talk about the election itself. We're just over 2 months out from election day. And what can we learn from how the election campaigns have been unfolding so far, and I guess are going to unfold as we get closer?
Well, you touch on a very important point, looking at the fact the election campaigns have in fact already been underway. A lot of the negotiations in Brussels, ever since we last looked at this in September, when we reviewed von der Leyen's State of the Union speech, when she was effectively launching her long campaign to be reappointed as president, with promises to the centre-right about reducing administrative burdens on business, promises to the left about establishing some social dialogue with the trade unions. And we've seen manifestos published during the first quarter. But of course, after this plenary, we go into the short campaign where MEPs return home. They will be working with their parties, knocking on doors. And I think a couple of the lessons that we will take from how things have played out the last few months are, firstly, that we're going to see quite a major policy reset in the autumn. Last time we looked at this in 2019, although we had a change of president, many of the files were simply carried over. A lot of the existing strategies were taken forward. And in fact, we had a number of commissioners effectively remaining in post with enhanced responsibilities or status, but continuing their agendas, most notably commissioners like Margareta Vestager or Valdis Dombrovskis. But this time we are going to see more of a reset. We'll probably see an attempt to define what we mean by competitiveness. We, of course, have an important report due out by Mario Draghi in July, and notably after the election, which will inform the Commission's thinking. But actually, the political parties have already been trying to define this through their manifestos, whether they are talking about a level playing field with the US and China, or whether they are talking about a need to reduce regulatory burdens on business, perhaps have a pause in some of the very ambitious environmental legislation. But at the same time, a lot of this is very contested. We, of course, have the Greens and the centre-left parties reminding everyone in Brussels that actually net zero by 2050 is enshrined in law. The need to have 2040 targets for emissions reduction are enshrined in both law and in international agreements. So actually, there will be a lot to play for in both defining the ambition level in environmental policy, but also the detail of how it's implemented in practice and how it can perhaps be done in ways that promote industrial interests rather than simply set top-down targets. But there is quite a lot to play for. And as I think we're going to come on to discuss, the makeup of the next parliament is actually quite unpredictable.
Yeah, you're setting me up perfectly for our next question. Speaking with clients across the board from lots of different countries, there's been a lot of fear and focus on the threat of a shift to the right. I think people were particularly spooked when Geert Wilders did well in the Netherlands. People were particularly spooked when Geert Wilders did as well as he did in the Netherlands, even though he's now been struggling to form a government. But I think this fear and this talk about a shift to the right has been on people's minds quite a lot. What do you think about this? Do you think this is going to materialize? Or what is your insight into what the shape of the next parliament might look like?
I think it will materialize, as you say, for a couple of reasons. One is that Wilders was not an isolated phenomenon in the Netherlands. You know, we also have Vlaams Belang at the top or near the top of opinion polls in Belgium. We had strong performance of far-right parties in Spain and Portugal. We've seen, of course, in Italy, two far-right parties forming the government and Giorgia Meloni herself as an ECR leader in the council. At the same time, there are trends across Germany and other member states. The second reason is that this election at the national level can often be a bit of a free hit against governing parties and mainstream parties. We consistently see that this election has relatively low turnout at the national level, and we see strong performance, not just by parties further to the right, but also parties further to the left, who voters would not necessarily want to put in charge of ministries or put into prime ministerial roles, but where it's a chance to express substantial discontent with governing parties. So I think that shift to the right is very important, but it's only important in increasing the number of MEPs representing those parties. As we've discussed before, the European Parliament is often more determined by the types of coalitions that can be formed between parties and inside parties than it is by the blunt numbers. And we saw in 2019, for example, one of the big questions was whether the centrist groups could cohere around a common platform. We'd had campaigns led by Emmanuel Macron in France with support from parties in Romania and elsewhere, but we'd also had traditional liberals in the ALDE group. And there was a big question, could they form a coalition after the elections rather than before? And I think we see a version of that affecting the right-wing parties you mentioned. You know, will the ECR group remain coherent? Will some of them be peeled off to work with the ID group, which is further to the right? Will some of them be peeled off to work with the EPP, which is a bit more to the centre? And that reflects both the diversity of that party and that group and those parties, but it also reflects the incentives that are at play to get access to funding, to get access to committee positions, to get access to other influential roles within the infrastructure. So I wouldn't be so direct in saying that a performance of the far right will translate into power in the parliament, because there'll be a lot to play for after the elections. And actually, June is going to be a fairly frantic period of deal making and coalitions. And a final point is that there will be some MEPs who are not affiliated to any group at all. We saw this last time around with, I think it was D66 and some of the more progressive centrist parties not being affiliated to a group. And of course, this time we have a fairly large cohort in Viktor Orban's Fidesz party not being aligned with any group. So there'll be quite a bit to play for after the elections as well as during the campaign.
You make a lot of very important points here. It's very interesting to understand how these parliamentary elections always reflect on people's satisfaction or dissatisfaction with national governments, how it maybe especially brings out people on kind of the further ends of either side of the spectrum. And of course, it is also very noteworthy that we're not talking about binary results here and the importance of and the complexity of coalition building after the elections. And I guess this point of what happens after the elections being particularly important brings me to the final question I want to ask you, which is, how do you think these elections are going to then impact the shape of the next commission?
Well, so we've looked at a story about fragmentation in the parliament, but it's also very important to remember there's also fragmentation at the national level. And there are, in each of the largest member states, the largest economies, quite an element of uncertainty about how they will approach setting the European agenda next time around. Most notably, we will see that Germany's hands are to an extent tied from supporting von der Leyen as the president. We see a minority government in Spain. How will they settle on nominating their commissioner? Emmanuel Macron is not in the strongest position in France. And of course, Italy is essentially untested in this kind of deal-making set. So whenever we work with our advisors in the member states, we really discover how unpredictable that is. But of course, the member states nominate the commissioners, but they then also need to be approved by the parliament through the committee hearings in the autumn. And that's assuming that a majority can be formed in favour of von der Leyen's reappointment herself. And that is itself far from guaranteed. She only got through last time, I think, with a majority of less than 10, which in a parliament of over 700 is fairly dicey. So can she get a majority in the parliament for a second term? And then do the member states' nominees survive that process of scrutiny? There's a lot to be tracking over the next few months. What we can draw out, though, are some of the discussions between the mainstream parties about what they will prioritise as their price for supporting von der Leyen and as their effectively instructions to their national commissioners. The first of those is that there needs to be an improved dialogue with business. One of the striking features of the 2019 policy cycle has been many businesses feeling that they are at arm's length. And so a look to have at least a commissioner or some structures in place that improve that sort of feedback. There's likely to be a focus on enlargement and on the relationships that need to deepen with Ukraine, Moldova, other countries to the east. So we could see a structural shift towards where commission powers are held for that. And there's also a recognition that more needs to be done on defence and security. And that can also shape the nature of the roles and the decision-making structures within the commission. So in summary, I would just say there is going to be an impact on how commissioners get through that will be driven a lot by the member states and the parliament. But once they are in post, the actual policy agenda of the commission will be determined by a much wider range of actors as well, including the business stakeholders and others.
Thanks very much, Tom. That's really helpful to understand not only how unpredictable the nomination process for commissioners is, but then the actual confirmation hearings in Parliament, von der Leyen's second term definitely not being assured, and what deals need to be struck to make these appointments happen. I think all really fascinating topics, and I'm sure we're going to speak again before the elections. And there's clearly lots of interesting things to keep in mind, not just for April, but for the next few months ahead. So thanks very much for this primer, Tom. Appreciate it.
No, thank you.
From the 17th of April, we are going to have central bank governors, finance and development ministers, civil society representatives, and an increasing number of private sector executives all gathering in Washington, D.C. for the IMF and the World Bank spring meetings. To discuss what is on the agenda, what the context for these meetings looks like, I have Thomas Gratowski with me. Thomas is a senior practice director here at GC. He leads our global macro work, and he's become a bit of a regular on the podcast. So very good to have you back. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Isabel. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we always do when we talk about the IMF meetings, I think it's really useful to just maybe set the scene a little bit. What is the economic context as we head into the meetings?
I think overall, the economic context is still rather
A complicated one. Growth for this year is expected to be relatively slow, like it was already last year. There has been some minor upgrade in January by the IMF World Economic Outlook update, and the International Monetary Fund is expected to provide its spring forecast now during the meeting. So we'll learn more about what they think about the current state of the global economy. But I think overall, there is a sense that despite things, the global economy being struggling at the moment, things are somewhat better than they could have been. And to some extent, perhaps the IMF and others have bought into that soft landing narrative, especially for the US economy. However, I would say a couple of things happened over the last several months. One is, of course, that a couple of economies like the UK, Germany, and Japan have slipped into recession. The Chinese economy is still struggling to a large extent. Domestic demand remains very weak. And that combined lack of global demand has, of course, led OPEC to extend its oil production cuts. And even though we have seen oil to some extent rebound over the last several weeks, I think overall the demand picture looks still relatively subdued. Now, I think what is especially important for emerging and developing economies is, of course, the interest rate setting in the United States and perhaps in other advanced economies. And there was an expectation that especially the US might move towards rate cuts, perhaps even at the end of the first quarter of this year. Now, this hasn't happened. Inflation has been stickier than hoped. But at the same time, the Fed has still not backtracked from its earlier plan to have 3 rate cuts this year, and has even said that there might be the potential for a reduction in the quantitative tightening program. So to some extent, we have seen quite contradictory, if you will, or quite a complicated setting of factors that have led policymakers for now to stick with the rate levels that we see at the moment. And it leaves on wondering if we were to move into more aggressive rate cuts, what the reason for those would be. And one interpretation is that policymakers are increasingly hedging their bets because the US economy is not as strong as many thought it was just a couple of months ago.
As you say, that sounds like quite a complex backdrop. So still this backdrop of slow growth, the recessions that you mentioned, UK, especially Germany, Japan. We've also had China, of course, struggling despite setting their continuously reasonably ambitious, but less and less credible target of 5% growth. And I think the questions that you raise about the credibility of the narrative around the US and how strong the US economy is particularly interesting. And I guess it's not just interesting for the US. The US is the powerhouse of the global economy right now. And if there are troubles, what does that mean for the rest of the world? And I'd be particularly interested in getting your take on whether you're seeing kind of further financial pressures, especially on emerging markets, because in the last few months, we've seen some really chunky new loan agreements from the IMF for emerging markets.
Absolutely. And I mean, basically what I meant to say was that longer high rates in the United States and other advanced economies are, of course, a burden for many emerging and developing economies that are in foreign currency. And the longer rates stay high, you know, countries need to refinance their debt, they need to take on new debt, it just becomes much harder and becomes much, much costlier. And so that is one of the reasons why we have actually seen now the IMF lending at record levels, actually at levels that you would usually only see probably during global recession episodes. Total lending is now near 150 billion, almost a quarter of the IMF membership now has an IMF program in place. So it's really, really significant. Some of them are the usual ones, like Argentina, whose massive loan program dates back a couple of years. But Egypt has been, for example, a recent country in which the IMF has struck a deal, now about 7 billion. Egypt is really in a complicated place for some of the factors that I mentioned before. But also the question there will be whether, you know, the government will be able to really successfully enact reforms, take on vested interests, make sure that inflation is not leading to political instability and all of that. So the IMF in that environment plays also a very complicated role because it needs to balance, of course, economic and debtor requirements with wider social concerns like about political stability. Some of the countries that you probably know more about, like Ghana and Ethiopia, are similarly in talks with the IMF or have recently gotten reimbursements from the IMF. So all of that actually means, and I think that's an important debate in Washington in a couple of weeks, to what extent the IMF's firepower is adequate, and what else needs to be done in addition to what has been done already.
I think you're perfectly setting me up for the next question, because these figures are so striking, both the 150 billion lent out right now, but also the fact that we have a quarter of IMF members with loan programs right now. What's your assessment of that? Do you think the firepower that the IMF currently has is enough?
So I think there have been some positive news recently that should at least give the fund some relief. One of the news was that the US Congress finally managed to get a budget deal done in March, which will help to unlock about 21 billion that the fund will have through a US lending for its poverty reduction and growth trust, which has become really the key mechanism to get basic interest-free loans to developing economies. And the fund expects demand for these loans this year will reach a record level. On top of that, and I think many of the discussions in Washington will probably revolve around the actual implementation of this, is that the IMF Board of Governors agreed in December on a 50% quota increase, which is really significant. And that quota increase also, and I think that's really important, took place without a quota realignment. So I think we talked about this in the past, that usually if you increase a quota of the IMF, you also need to do that in a way that increasingly reflects the share of its membership in the global economy. And of course, that would mean that China would have a much larger quota. Now, with an quota increase without a quota realignment, you basically get rid of that problem. And China, of course, was against this approach towards a quota increase. And also not every member of the IMF voted in favor of it. So my suspicion is that actually Beijing voted against it. But nonetheless, it means that basically until mid-November, countries now have time to put this IMF agreement into their usual budgetary processes and into law. And so by the end of the year, the expectation is that the IMF will really have a much more significant firepower available than it currently has. Of course, as I mentioned, you know, that whole geopolitical question about, you know, control of the IMF, greater say for emerging and developing economies, greater say for China, is not going away. The IMF has said that there will be some recommendations worked out until June of next year about how this quota realignment could be done. But of course, next year, the world might look very different. We might have President Trump in the White House. We might have concerns that are perhaps elsewhere. And so basically this kicked the can down the road and focused on the more pressing issues for emerging market and developing economies, which is actually getting the required financing that they need as soon as possible.
I think this is an absolutely fascinating topic. I could always imagine people's eyes slightly glazing over when people talking about quota realignment of the IMF. But this is, it sounds quite obscure, but it really is an absolutely vital thing, because it would fundamentally change how the fund is controlled, how the voting shares play out, and to better reflect economic realities. I think it would be, a massive and fundamental change to the IMF. And I guess I'm nicely trying to bring myself to my other point that I want to raise by talking about how the IMF is controlled, because I guess the person at the very top, Kristalina Georgieva, the current managing director of the IMF, she's been in charge since 2019, and her current term runs out this year. And there's been increasing kind of mumblings about whether she's going to get a second term. What's your thinking on this, Thomas? Have you heard anything about what's happening with Georgieva?
So I think she has done a good job, and I think most people would agree with that. I think she is also probably a perfect candidate, at least from the United States and European perspective, as an Eastern European, making sure the IMF really supports Ukraine in this war against Russia, has been really, really important. So I think in that sense, I expect her to get again the backing from Europeans and from the United States. Now, the only caveat, or there are two caveats I have to mention. One is that actually in 2019, Europe nominated her as the IMF managing director in order to compensate Eastern European nations for actually not getting major roles in other European institutions. So maybe you remember, you know, a German became a commission president, Lagarde, ECB president, a Belgian became the president of the European Council, and an Italian became the president of the European Parliament. And so no one from Eastern Europe actually became one of the top, or got one of the top jobs. And so the IMF opening was perfect to deal with that problem. And of course, this year, again, we have elections to the European Parliament. And so I expect that if we don't see at least a formal nomination of her now in the spring meetings and a very clear statement from Europe and the United States that she should be the next candidate, you know, I could imagine that maybe that role is again up for discussion as part of the wider discussions in Europe about top job positions after the European election. Secondly, I think I mentioned the Ukraine aspect. Of course, in parts of the so-called global South, there have been also concerns about, you know, the West focusing too much on Ukraine, but actually forgetting or not at least putting as much attention towards the needs of other emerging developing economies. I think the US's budget deal, the quota increase will probably help to alleviate those concerns, but I don't think they will go away. And everyone knows that, you know, Europe has had the IMF presidency or the managing directorship rather since its creation. And so there's always this question about, you know, whether that needs to change at one point and whether now is the right time to do so. So I think all these discussions will be really interesting to follow in Washington in a couple of weeks. But my base case is that Georgieva will remain managing director at the IMF. Also, and then lastly, we talked about some of the challenges the IMF faces at the moment. You know, changing the leadership right now would also have its own challenges, more, you know, from an operational perspective, how you actually run a fund in times of such a crisis environment.
Thanks very much, Thomas. It was actually a fascinating interlinkage between the European election topic that I'm discussing with Tom in the podcast, which I wasn't expecting. So thanks very much for bringing those two topics together. And we'll definitely keep an eye on the IMF and the World Bank meetings. We'll keep an eye on Georgieva and all of the other big topics that are happening at the meetings. Thanks very much, Thomas.
Thank you.
On this note, we are at the end of this episode of the Global Month Ahead podcast. We are clearly looking at a very interesting April. We will see elections kick off in India, so we're definitely not going to see any results just yet. We will get a sense of what the European Parliament manages to accomplish before they too head into campaign and later election season. And we will see what countries manage to agree at the IMF and World Bank meetings, including whether we will have a formal endorsement of a second term for Kristalina Georgieva. As always, if you, your business, or your investment are exposed to any of what we've discussed today, please don't hesitate to get in touch. You can find contact details for our presenters and our sectoral teams on the GC website at www.global-council.com or via the link in the podcast notes. Thank you, Ross, Tom, and Thomas, and thanks to you for listening.